Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on today's program, how to get health insurance and caring for pets during the coronavirus pandemic. But up front, with so many Pennsylvanians out of work suddenly, children not getting meals at school, and others who are at home and not traveling, access to food has been one of the biggest concerns during the COVID-19 emergency. Joining us on the first portion of today's program to talk about food is Pennsylvania Secretary of Agriculture Russell Redding. Secretary Redding, welcome to the program.
Scott, always good to hear your voice. Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary Redding, is there enough food in Pennsylvania during this pandemic?
Yes. There's no food shortage. I will tell you that we are challenged to respond to how and where people are buying food. I mean, just as a point of history, we have shifted to about half of our food purchases being outside the home and the other half in the home. As you can appreciate, that is a process that is going to take a little time to realign, because now we're buying almost 100% of our food at the retail setting and bringing it into our home versus eating it outside. So there are inside the food system changes that are occurring and are responding. But at the end of the day, there's no shortage of food.
And there are several aspects of hunger and food distribution that we'll be discussing during the program. But I want to start with grocery stores, because that's what affects most people. Grocery stores are open. They have made some changes, offering certain hours for older shoppers, maybe change their hours a little bit, closed overnight to restock shelves. But do they have enough food? Is the food supply good in Pennsylvania to our grocery stores?
Yes, it is. Again, they are challenged to respond to the surge of folks who are coming in to buy, and there are some supply chain issues. But in terms of the food being available, it's there. It just may be a logistics issue of getting it to them and getting it stocked and trying to keep up with demand. But in terms of the supply itself, it is adequate. It's reliable. It's being around the clock managed to make sure that we get it on the shelves.
When you say that there are some supply chain issues, was that what you just mentioned, getting it to them, transportation, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I mean, they're both the repackaging of items. As I noted earlier, a lot of food is packaged in what would be termed sort of a food service type packaging, right? So it's a flat of eggs, it's the gallon can of tomatoes and such. Now all that now has to be repackaged into smaller containers for retail sales. But that's the turn that's really challenging at the moment for the food manufacturers.
I was going to say the Department of Agriculture has put out some guidance for grocery stores. Health and safety of those working in the stores, we'll talk about customers in just a moment, but how do you ensure that those people who are working in the grocery stores, that they are not contracting the COVID-19 virus?
Yeah, so that's been a high priority for the governor and the Department of Agriculture over the last couple of weeks. And we have issued guidance documents on a number of topics, one of them being around the retail food and manufacturing and making sure that our grocery stores are, doing all of the right things, and the right things being, making sure that from sanitation to the hand washing, all of the social distancing components, the personal hygiene. And that has been one of our primary initiatives, but I can tell you the retailers themselves have been hyper about this, making sure that they're protecting their employees, that they're putting up guards at checkout, sneeze guards, as one example, making sure that they're packaging items in smaller packages, things that people don't have to touch. there's a lot of that has gone on, but they've really worked hard, and I really appreciate the retailers and the employees who are on the front line making this work. But that's been a priority for us, and making sure that they're safe and consumers are safe and the food is safe.
Those sneeze guards, I've been wondering whether those are permanent.
Well, I think our world has changed to now include things like that as normal.
So from here on out, it wouldn't be a surprise if you walk into a store, you walk up to the cashier, and you're seeing a sneeze guard. What about customer safety? I mean, all the things that you just talked about to protect the workers, obviously they are there to protect the customers as well.
Yes. Yep. Yes, they are. So I think those practices that are adopted by the retailers and employees as good management practices, are there for two reasons. One is to protect the employees, of course, but the other is to make sure that the customers are safe and feel comfortable coming in. So when we grab the shopping cart going into the store and you use the alcohol pad to clean off the handle, using those at different points throughout the store to make sure that we're clean and customers are safe. But I think the heightened sensitivity by retailers, and I'll just say the entire food system, to some of those protocols, it's really been reassuring as I've talked to a lot of retailers and processors and folks in the farm community about what they're doing to protect not just the employees, but that food system that we've come to appreciate and we see the value of as part of our state and national security at the moment is really critical.
Is there food going to waste?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I had these concerns early on of just the amount of buying that was happening and the bulk that was occurring. But I have less concern about it now. Just in my mind, I've come to accept that we are not eating out anywhere with few exceptions. And all of that food is being consumed in the home. So I don't believe that there's as much waste as maybe would have been anticipated in the front side because of our being captive to our homes and kitchens.
We have an email here from Howard in Mechanicsburg. It says, mushroom growers are currently dumping tons of fresh mushrooms due to the loss of market. Now, I can't confirm this. I'm only going by the email. What, if anything, is PDA doing to address this loss of the state's only number one crop in the U.S.?
Yeah. So again, it's a result. And by the way, I don't have that as confirmed either. But I can appreciate that just the amount of mushrooms that went into the food service side of our consumption. I can picture mushrooms that are not destined for those restaurants and that trade now being they have a shelf life, right? They're perishable. So you could have some considerable loss there. We do have a couple of options. I mean, the USDA purchases, part of this waiver that the governor secured with the temporary emergency food assistance program is one. We have an agricultural surplus system that we're buying surplus product and putting it into the food system. So that's happening, though, throughout from dairy to mushrooms and apples and so forth. So we're trying to respond to that. But just everybody appreciates, I mean, this change that's occurred in our consumption patterns is causing a lot of pain in how do we retool the food system to respond to almost an exclusive home consumption now versus being shared outside the home. That's a big change for the food industry.
I'm going to switch gears now and talk about those who may be food insecure or were getting meals at school. Just yesterday, the U.S. Department of Agriculture provided a waiver so that schools can offer free meals to all children, no matter their family economic status. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll just mention, all of our work in the food, the charitable food space has been a shared partnership with the Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and Department of Agriculture. This particular program that you referenced is part of the Department of Education and their work with schools. We have a piece of it, but this particular waiver is really critical, as you note, because prior to the change, only those students who met certain income eligibility and we're 50% in the free or reduced meal category. could access. And the waiver now removes that provision. So all students in that district, irrespective of their income eligibility, can now access food. That's a big deal, right? It's not unlike what the governor secured in the waiver, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, getting rid of these income eligibility waivers, because we're now living in a time where that is, it is important, of course, but with number of people experiencing unemployment compensation and being unemployed for the first time, the surge in the charitable food system has been overwhelming. So anything we can do to feed kids at school, at school sites, or in the greater community that don't have the income eligibility attached to them is really a great gift and a benefit right now.
If the people who are food insecure, and there probably are more today because of people losing jobs, you mentioned several programs, several waivers, but what is happening on the federal level and on the state level, and the two of you have worked together on this, it's not just Pennsylvania, but other states as well, to ensure that people who are insecure, food insecure, are getting the food that they need?
Well, it's a full partnership, you know, and I say it all the time that, you know, when you think about the food safety net in Pennsylvania, think of it as a pyramid. So at the very bottom, we have our private giving, private support, as you and I would support our local food bank or charitable organization. On top of that, you have the state support that our legislature and the governor provide every year in our state food purchase program. And on the very top of the pyramid is the federal program. So this Emergency Food Assistance Program is one example. But that whole pyramid right now is the food safety net that Pennsylvanians and those across America are relying on. And it's critical that every one of those pieces work and work well. And that's what we're trying to achieve here with the waivers and pushing the system, if you will, to respond. Having talked to the food banks, I know they're overwhelmed. They've got the same challenges of staffing. They've got issues of supply. They have issues of trying to get items in the right consumer size and availability of that. So it's going to take the entire pyramid, the entire system to respond to make this work and make sure that folks who are irrespective of why they are hungry, that they get food, whether out of work, not in school, they're displaced by college, whatever. We want to make sure that every single person has access to food. That's our challenge. The governor's been very clear to all of us in the cabinet about that, is at this time of uncertainty, let's at least make sure that people have access to food.
There are a lot of challenges. I mean, just getting the food in, that the food banks, the pantries, the food that they need, because there are so many other clients that are coming to them. Also understand that there is a shortage of volunteers, especially at this time when many people are staying at home and we're told to social distance, but the food banks are having a little bit of a challenge. Well, I shouldn't say a little bit, a challenge getting volunteers, correct?
Yeah, they have a big challenge. I think it's one of the things right now as we think of needs. There's obviously food needs, there are financial needs, but there's also the human capital need. I mean, people just with time who are healthy, who are willing to sort of pitch in and help out, it's essential. I mean, I think anybody who can donate a little bit of time to help box food and distribute food, they need you, we need you right now. So, you know, going to the feedingpennsylvania.org website, you can look up sort of where the food banks are and talk about sort of what you can do in terms of volunteering. But it's a really critical need right now. And also think about the volunteers who have historically been in the food banks, maybe seniors, you know, folks who are have got time and they've dedicated their lives to helping out in the food bank. Right now, they're a vulnerable population, so they're stepping aside for the safety and social distancing. So somebody has to step in to try to fill that void. So volunteers are critical right now.
You know, this is just the beginning of the planting season in Pennsylvania for many crops. Is the food in our grocery stores coming from out of state?
It comes from all over. I mean, certainly, I can walk up and down the aisles in the store and point to Pennsylvania product that's either grown here or processed here. A lot of what we have in the stores right now comes from across America. I'd say the same is true for, you know, folks in other parts of the state to see a lot of stuff, or other parts of the country, you see product from Pennsylvania. you know, as we shift into, you know, the growing season, you'll see more Pennsylvania product. But right today, you know, if you go to the dairy case, it's Pennsylvania. The eggs are Pennsylvania. You know, there's, you know, apples that have been in storage from Pennsylvania. So a lot of product from Pennsylvania, either raw product or is processed here, is in our stores.
And we had an email from a listener who asked, could you comment on the changes and improvement a more local food source could have in regional, national times that require social distancing? Are there other systems of distribution beyond corporate food? And by corporate food, I think this person is referring to what you described, food coming from all over. But, you know, so many of us in the last few years have been dedicated to buying local. It seems as though that may not be a priority at this time.
Well, it's interesting. We've been overwhelmed with inquiries about where can I buy food at farm markets, you know, and locally is the question. So it is on people's minds. It's top of mind for a lot of folks. And I think it's one of these moments when for a lot of society, they are rediscovering, you know, the power of a local food system. And we are lucky in Pennsylvania to have that full spectrum of, you know, direct farm sales from farm and buying local to those who can supply the larger chain. That is all in Pennsylvania. I think it's one of our real strengths as a state, and it shows right now when that system is being asked to respond as never before. But for folks who want to buy local, absolutely look around, you know, look at your community, you know, look for the farm markets and farm distributions. We did put out guidance, by the way, for farms and on-farm deliveries and farm markets, just to make sure that for folks who are doing it are also mindful of the employees and their families, of the precautions they need to take for the COVID-19 as well. So, but it's a great sort of time to think about our food system and to, I think, appreciate what we have both in our capacity but also the diversity in the farms and farm families who are making that happen. So that's the silver lining, I think, at the moment. It's just people really appreciating food. Where does it come from and who's feeding is a great question.
Secretary Redding, how is Pennsylvania's ag economy overall being impacted by this emergency?
Well, I'm proud of it, and it's really how they persevered, the farm community and the ag community over the last couple of years, you know, have not been kind, either by weather or by trade concerns and labor concerns. At the moment, I will tell you that there's a lot of hope and optimism, but there is concern about what is happening in some of our food systems shutting down, in the sense that we have a lot of food companies that really have been in the business of supplying the restaurant trade, if you will, in terms of packaging, and they're struggling to make this transition over to consumer items at the moment. But in terms of supply, it's strong. I think our guys are optimistic that, you know, we're going to improve with a growing year here, and markets get opened up again. And, you know, they take a long view of business. They don't look at the seasons or the year, but I've been impressed with what they have done to prepare. We have also asked them to be thinking about their own continuity of operations plan, as we do for other businesses right now too. But they're resolute in making sure that we have a food supply that's available and reliable and safe. So proud of them.
We're getting a number of people asking about volunteer opportunities at food banks. Did you say, Secretary, to go to your website to find some of those places?
No, I would recommend they go to feedingpennsylvania.org. It's feedingpa.org or hungerfreepennsylvania.org.
Okay. Secretary of Agriculture Russell Redding, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Thousands of Pennsylvanians have been laid off from their jobs or lost their jobs completely, and with them went their health insurance. So what options do they have to get health insurance? Joining us now is Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner, Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. As I said, Commissioner Altman, many people lost their health insurance when they lost their jobs. Do they have options to get coverage?
Yeah, so first of all, it is such a challenging time to lose your health insurance because healthcare is clearly front of mind for so many people right now. But the message I have is there are choices. There are three things that we should talk about. The first is COBRA. The second is the health insurance marketplace or healthcare.gov. And then the third is medical assistance or CHIP. So there are options out there depending on your situation and in particular, whatever ongoing income you may have.
I want to start with COBRA. And the reason being is because before healthcare.gov and Obamacare, as it became known, if someone lost their job, this was really the only option they had, or one of the few options they had, was to purchase COBRA insurance. And what they would do is they would be able to purchase the insurance they have through their employer, but at the same rate that the employer was paying. All right, so that is available now. Is that an option? I mean, obviously it's an option, but is it a good option for those who have lost their jobs?
Yeah, it is definitely an option. First of all, you get to keep the coverage that you had with your employer. Employer coverage can often be very generous in its benefits, and so that's something to consider. You also would get to, if you had, for example, spent money on care and you have a deductible, that would continue. Your deductible would not start over. So that's an important thing to think about for the pocketbook. But COBRA can be quite expensive on a monthly basis. And the reason for that is that normally with your employer health insurance, you have a contribution and your employer has a contribution. So you're paying a part of it and your employer is paying a part of it. When you move on to COBRA, your employer stops making their contribution and you will need to pay now the full cost of that insurance on a monthly basis, which can be, in some cases, quite expensive.
Well, and that's what I was thinking of. When there are other options out there and COBRA is so expensive, and I guess I'll ask the question again, is it a good option?
It really does depend, and we would certainly encourage any person leaving employer coverage to look at their options before making a decision. The marketplace will generally be the comparable option. If you're eligible for medical assistance, that's going to be very affordable. That's where you should go. But if you're comparing the marketplace versus COBRA, you'll need to understand, are you eligible for a subsidy in the marketplace? You'll want to compare benefits. You'll want to look at, where are you in your deductible with your employer plan, because you will start over in that deductible with the marketplace. So those are things you want to think about. There are resources to help you think through that process. You can always call my office, the insurance department. There are also free, unbiased organizations called Navigators working in our communities who get dollars just to help people think through their insurance options. So there are resources out there, but I would never tell people go one way or the other, but I would certainly tell them to think through all of their options and make an informed decision.
I have to admit, Commissioner, that insurance is one of those areas that it can get complicated for many people. You just said the marketplace, and what you're referring to is healthcare.gov, correct?
That's correct.
Right.
Healthcare.gov, also known as the insurance marketplace.
Right.
We do have our lingo in insurance, that's for sure.
I just wanted to make sure that everyone understood that. But one of the next questions that many people have or would say, well, I can't do that because there's only an open enrollment period toward the end of the year. What about that open enrollment?
So this is really important because there are special marketplace. You can enroll in any time throughout the year.
Okay, Commissioner, we're losing you right now. With I assume you're on a cell phone. Are you there, Commissioner? All right, we're We're going to call Commissioner Altman back and try to get her on a better line, or may, at least somewhere. You know, this is something that, as you probably have noticed, that all our guests on Smart Talk have been over the phone, because we are not having people during this time, during this emergency, come into the studio. And as fewer and fewer people have landlines, we're going to be talking to people on their cell phones. And we know that cell phone service isn't always reliable and clear. So this is an issue that we're going to be dealing with over the next few weeks in particular. I should also mention, while I have this minute, while we're calling Commissioner Altman back, is that many of the questions that you send in, we are transferring. We have a frequently asked questions section on our website, WITF.org. It's at WITF.org/coronavirus. Many of the questions that you have sent in, a lot of them that haven't been answered, we put there and try to get answers for you. Just today with Secretary Redding on, we had a couple questions that weren't answered on the air that we'll try to get to that frequently asked questions section. But it is a wealth of information, because questions that I know there are a lot of websites that have questions that people have about the coronavirus and COVID-19, but this is some of the simplest ones and some of the most, some of the ones that are asking for complicated explanations, but it's a wonderful resource. It's at WITF.org/coronavirus. I understand that Commissioner Altman is back on the line. Commissioner, are you there?
Yes, and hopefully you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay.
Great.
So what we were talking about is, you were talking about the open enrollment period, and you started to cut out when you were explaining the difference between open enrollment at the end of the year and what can happen now.
Great. So, open enrollment is the one time a year that anybody can enroll. But even throughout the rest of the year, you can enroll in certain circumstances. There's something called a special enrollment period. And one of the things that can qualify you for a special enrollment period is a significant change in your life. Now, one of those changes is if you lose health insurance coverage from another source, including an employer. So I want to say that one more time. If you had health insurance from your employer and you lose that insurance, you can get coverage on the marketplace right now through a special enrollment period, as long as you do that within 60 days of losing your prior coverage.
That is important. I'm sure there are a lot of people who aren't aware of that. The state received a waiver from the federal government that would provide greater flexibility with Medicaid and the CHIP programs. What does that mean to insurance consumers?
Sure. So I'm not an expert on Medicaid and the waiver that was applied for, so I can't speak in detail to that. But I do want to talk a little bit about medical assistance and CHIP. These are programs that are run by the state, funded by public dollars, that provide affordable coverage to certain groups like those who have disabilities, but also to our lowest income Pennsylvanians, particularly medical assistance. CHIP is the Children's Health Insurance Program. It serves Pennsylvania's children. And one unique thing about Pennsylvania's CHIP program is any child in the Commonwealth, regardless of income, can get CHIP. So, how much you pay for it will vary depending on your income, but if you have children who need coverage, absolutely it is important to get them covered, and CHIP is a place that you can look for coverage.
Yeah, that is something that is universal, and that every Pennsylvanian should understand that, and a child is considered someone under the age of 18, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So if a child under the age of 18, that they are eligible for insurance no matter what. Now, there is cost involved, but they are eligible for the CHIP program. With Medicaid, and understand the situation you're in, Commissioner, because the Department of Human Services administers a lot of this. But with Medicaid, there are income limits, correct?
That's correct. The good thing here, just because insurance can be so complicated, is the Medicaid program or medical assistance and the marketplace are connected. So if you go in to apply for the marketplace and they look at your income and say, you're actually going to be eligible for medical assistance, they'll get you there. And if you go into medical assistance and you apply and it turns out you make just a little bit too much, they'll get you to the marketplace where you should be eligible for financial assistance, once again, depending on your income. And we can talk more about financial assistance on the marketplace as well.
Okay, let's do that then. Go ahead.
Sure. So 80% of Pennsylvanians who are currently on the marketplace receive financial assistance. Now, all of those people receive help paying for that monthly premium. They get more assistance if they have lower income, less assistance if they have higher income. But many of them also receive help paying for those out-of-pocket costs like copays, deductibles, et cetera. And, you know, every year during the normal open enrollment period, I attend events where people are getting help enrolling. And so many people say they didn't think they would be eligible for financial assistance, and then they find out that they are, and the insurance is more affordable than they thought that it would be.
I have to say, Commissioner, that in the last 3 or 4 weeks, there's been so much focus during the crisis on getting tested for COVID-19 and getting treated if someone is sick, that we haven't heard much about ability to pay for testing or treatment. Now, that doesn't mean that providers are not billing people, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, I mean, testing, we heard that with the federal legislation, that testing would be free. That is, if you are not insured, correct?
Actually, no.
Oh, really?
Everyone should be able to get the test for free. So, you know, the new federal legislation did provide funding for the uninsured to make sure the test was free, but it also required that all health insurers provide the test with no cost sharing to the patient. Now, actually, all of Pennsylvania's health insurers had agreed to do that even before they were required to by law. So we've really seen them come to the table from the beginning understanding this. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't necessarily be costs associated with, going to the doctor, but the test itself has no cost sharing associated with it. Many insurers are taking additional steps. We're seeing a huge expansion in access to telemedicine. So whether you have mild symptoms for COVID or you need something else, but you really don't want to go to the doctor's office, to the urgent care, because you're trying to stay away from people as you're being advised to do right now, you can get on the phone, you can get on Skype with providers or other video technologies and do that now via technology. We've also seen some insurers even waive cost sharing associated with treatment. So if you have private health insurance in the Commonwealth, I would very much recommend, if you're concerned about COVID-19, that you talk to your insurance company or look at their website and see the special things that they are doing to make access more readily available to their policyholders.
We have a question from Stephanie who asks, will health plans allow groups to fill prescriptions early so they can have a 30-day supply on hand and could be a 90-day supply? I know that's the same question as apply. What guidance are you giving to health insurers?
Yeah, so we have given guidance to our health insurers, instructing them to do exactly that. What we want to do is make sure that any person who has a maintenance medication that they need on an ongoing basis doesn't have to be going into the pharmacy every month, every 2 weeks to pick up that prescription. We want them to be able to get it for a longer amount of time. We have asked insurance companies to do that. Anyone who certainly tries to do that and is not successful can absolutely contact my office, but it is our expectation that insurers are offering that flexibility.
Commissioner, will there be Pennsylvanians getting hit with bills in a few months?
So, I think we will see healthcare costs associated with care. They have not waived cost sharing for everything. So if you have a deductible and you end up in the hospital and you don't have an insurer who's waived cost sharing associated with treatment, we are going to see some of those things. We've also put our insurers on notice to be flexible with things like if you end up at an out-of-network provider instead of an in-network one because of capacity issues. We want to keep a very special eye out for surprise balance billing, which is an issue we've been talking about even outside of this context. So, you know, we've said you need to do right by your policyholders, but billing is complicated. Insurance companies don't always see the bill before it goes to the policyholder. So anyone who gets a bill that they're not expecting that seems wrong, first of all, you should contact your insurance company. Second of all, if you're really concerned about it, you can absolutely contact my office. We have a team of people who do a wonderful job helping people, advocating for Pennsylvanians if they do see problems with their insurance.
What is the phone number to contact your office?
Yeah, so our consumer services hotline is 877-881-6388. Or you can visit us on our website and contact us online at insurance.pa.gov.
Commissioner, there has been at least one case where a family, there was a person who died because they were afraid of going to the doctor because of the cost. How can we keep that from happening here in Pennsylvania, really anywhere?
Here's what I would say. There are many people and organizations who are here to help. If you are concerned about affording care right now, call the Commonwealth, call us at the Insurance Department, call the Department of Health hotline for COVID-19. There is funding to assist the uninsured that is coming from the federal government. There, you may be eligible to get insurance throughout the year, medical assistance. We actually didn't talk about that in CHIP. You can enroll any time of the year if you're eligible. We don't want anyone forgoing care because they're afraid of the cost. And just reach out, and there are people here to help.
Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. While many people are at home during the COVID-19 emergency, they're spending more time with their pets, as well as posting pictures of their dogs and cats on social media. But what about when those people get sick? And other questions concerning pet care and the pets. Joining us now is Kristen Dunmoyer, Director of the Bureau of Dog Law Enforcement with the Pennsylvania Department of Education, or excuse me, Agriculture. Director Dunmoyer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Also joining us is Dr. Brian Langwa, Medical Director of the Pet Pantry of Lancaster County and immediate past president of the Pennsylvania Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Langwa, welcome to the show as well.
Oh, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I want to get this out of the way right off the bat, and I'll start with you, Dr. Langwa. Can pets contract COVID-19?
No. While there have been some isolated cases of them actually finding evidence of the virus in a couple of dogs and a cat, currently there is no scientific evidence or research that shows that pets can actually become infected with COVID-19 or transmit it to people.
All right. So there was the second question, big question, that they cannot transmit it to people, even though those pets may be in close social contact with us and we have our hands on them, maybe hugging them and all that, that the virus cannot live on the surface, the fur of a dog or cat.
Well, the virus itself technically can survive on kind of like the fur of a dog or cat. What we have found, though, in looking at it, is that while it can, live on the fur is a very porous substance. So it's very hard for the virus then to leave the fur and then kind of come onto your hand or around your face or things like that. In scientific theory, it certainly is possible that your pet could act as what we call a fomite, or just something that a virus could land on and then you pick up from touching it. But there's no scientific evidence really right now to back that up. And the virus, because the hair is very porous, again, tends to stick to it and doesn't survive as long. So it's very hard for it to be transmitted that way.
I have heard this people having this argument back and forth because they have cited those cases that you mentioned where there have been several animals that have found to have the coronavirus, but still they are not transmitting it or contracting it. Director Dunmoyer, are kennels still open during this crisis, and are there any changes to how they are operating?
Yes. So right now we do have shelters, rescues, sanctuaries, as well as boarding kennels and doggy daycares and pet stores that sell pet supplies considered as essential. And that is for any workers that have essential jobs that need somewhere to put their dogs, as well as we want to continue making sure there's a safe place for any stray dogs, any dogs that need to be rehomed as well.
But how is social distancing being maintained? I mean, I do know that with my own veterinarian that they've come up with a method where there's not as much physical contact being made. What are those businesses that you mentioned, what are they doing?
Sure. The shelters and kennels are following guidelines for social distancing. They're limiting the public coming into the facilities. The shelters themselves are doing a lot of virtual style adoptions. They're also encouraging the use of foster homes to keep the dogs out of the shelter facility. They're limiting to no more than 10 people in a group, following the wipe down measures for any high traffic areas, as well as bathing any incoming dogs into the facilities.
So that's happening on a regular basis, and I mean, every dog that's coming in is getting bathed?
That was our recommendation to them. I certainly hope that that is happening, washing down any cages frequently. The same recommendations that you're seeing for, like, the grocery stores and other essential businesses are the same recommendations for the shelters as well, and the kennels, the boarding kennels.
You said that you're encouraging foster care rather than, maybe I shouldn't say rather than, in addition to when there is an animal that needs shelter. How would that work during this this situation?
The foster care is simply just an individual who's willing to house the dog until its forever home can be found. So it would avoid being at a shelter completely, and the foster owner would then be responsible for caring for that dog, much like they would if they had a personal pet.
Hmm. Dr. Langlois, I'm curious, as a veterinarian, are you seeing anything different from your clients while this is going on the last 3 weeks to a month?
Not really. I mean, the type of practice I do is more shelter medicine, nonprofit, as well as lower cost spay neuter. So the one thing we have noticed, obviously, and that, you know, obviously is a little bit of a burden to a lot of people, is that spays and neuters, unless there's a life-saving component to it, are basically considered elective procedures. So in order to save on PPE for the hospitals and the human side, we've been asked to basically postpone any elective procedures, you know, for at least the next couple of weeks, maybe a little bit longer, to allow those supplies to go elsewhere. So that certainly has affected a lot of veterinarian places. But we still are seeing urgent cases, sick animals, emergency cases. And really, that really hasn't changed in talking to a lot of vets in the area that I know. They still are seeing those cases and things like that. It's more the elective cases that we're postponing. And, you know, we're just asking owners to be understanding that they really should, if they do have a problem, call ahead to their veterinarian to make sure that their vet can see their pet, as well as understand the procedures that are going to be there. As you talked a little bit about with your vet, most of them are doing what we call curbside drop-off. So a technician will come out, take the animal from you, bring it inside. You'll stay in your car as the owner, and then the vet will contact you or call you once the exam is done to discuss things. So we're trying to do as much as we can to still be able to take care of those animals that are in need, but also, you know, protect our staffs and ourselves, too, from getting sick.
Other than spayed and neuter, are there other elective procedures that are being foregone right now?
Another thing would potentially be declaw surgeries are considered electives. Sometimes small lump removals that have been there for a while, like a fatty mass or something that, you know, was scheduled to come off. It doesn't necessarily, it's not an emergency situation. Nail trims, what we call wellness exams, so kind of like yearly appointments that potentially can wait a little bit, you know, until things calm down. Some vaccines, you know, we are postponing a little bit as well. Just to make sure that we kind of keep the social distancing thing in effect.
Mark from Lancaster asks, I've been furloughed and have more time at home. Are there ways to adopt pets during this social distancing shutdown time?
Yes, they are. I would start with reaching out to the local county shelter. And there is a shelter in Lancaster, as well as I believe Dr. Langlois' pet pantry as well is one of those.
Mm-hmm. So when you say reach out, by phone or just how?
They can go online on their website, or they can call. and they can set up appointments to view the dog.
Yeah, because, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, will walk in. You know, you don't have to normally have to make an appointment, just want to see the animals that are eligible for adoption. So what you're saying is that can't happen right now.
Correct. You can't just walk into the facility, but you can go online, either reach out to them via email or you can place a phone call and they can set up a way for you to do meet and greets with any potential dogs that you have interest in.
You said dogs. What about cats?
Cats are included in that. I'm sorry. I'm used to dog law. So
well, yeah, yeah. I guess you are. Don't think. Think about the other side, Director Dunboyer.
I know.
Are pets considered when it comes to emergency food distribution? I talked with Secretary Redding, the Department of Agriculture, about food with humans in the first segment of today's program. What about dogs? Dogs and cats. Is food for them considered part of the emergency food distribution?
It absolutely is, yes. And we do on our website have a list of pet food pantries for anybody who might be struggling to find dog food or dog necessities.
What is your website so that we can make that available on our website if people want to go directly to it?
Sure. It's agriculture.pa.gov/COVID.
So you actually have a COVID-19 section mapped out that people can go to?
We do on our website. That's resources for humans, pets, pet owners, everything.
Hmm. Veterinary facilities, for what you've discussed so far, Dr. Langlois, are considered essential businesses during this shutdown, correct?
Yes, veterinarians are considered essential and life-sustaining. And as I said, we're there for the purpose of seeing the urgent, you know, sick cases or emergency cases. The elective procedures right now, at the request of the government, basically have been postponed at least for a couple of weeks, maybe a little bit longer.
What's considered emergency?
Basically, anything that would be, you know, causing your animal pain. If there's all of a sudden they're not able to bear weight on a leg. If they have prolonged vomiting and diarrhea, if you know that they might have eaten something that might have become, you know, stuck in their intestines. For cats, if you notice all of a sudden that they can't urinate, some cats are prone to urinary blockage, just not doing well, not eating. It kind of, we have a little bit of discretion, and that's why we urge people to call their vet, because, you know, their vet can ask some further questions to determine if it's something that absolutely needs to be seen or if it's something that potentially can wait a little bit. But we're always going to err on the side of caution. So if we're not sure as vets, we're going to say still bring the animal in so that we can check it. You know, we don't want anybody potentially, you know, missing something or having their pet suffer a little bit more just because we weren't sure if it fell into a specific definition. And the other thing that is becoming more prevalent now, and people can talk to their vets about this, is telehealth and veterinary medicine. So as veterinarians can't see clients, you know, in person, some of them are setting up ways to virtually, you know, talk to them about their pets for minor things and offer advice that way as well.
We have a question from Louise in Harrisburg who asks, are dog parks safe or should I avoid them to do social distancing? Director Dunboyer, what about that?
Yeah, so at this point, I would say to be careful. You know, you could go to a dog park if there was no other people there. Right now, we really are trying to practice social distancing. So it would be best to just, you know, leash your dog and walk through your neighborhood, avoiding any other animals or individuals with, you know, keeping at least 6 feet distance.
So are dog parks open?
That would be up to the individual township. I've not heard of any specifically closing, but again, just much like playgrounds for children, I would think dog parks are going to be the same way, and it would be up to the individual municipalities whether or not they're closing those.
Yeah, it would seem that that would be an area where social distancing may be a little bit more difficult. There's just so much activity in a dog park, and you know, the dogs interacting with one another ends up that people end up interacting. I don't know, just an observation, but I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Kristen Dunmoyer, Director of the Bureau of Dog Law Enforcement with the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, and Dr. Brian Langlois, Medical Director of the Pet Pantry of Lancaster County. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And tomorrow we will continue our conversation, COVID-19, the coronavirus. We focus on a different aspect of every day during this emergency, so be sure to tune in.